Welcome back. So I hope the first part has been useful and interesting. I know I've been going kind of fast through some you know, technically I didn't do anything actually very hard, but going at that rate and conceptually and new notation, new language, I know it might have been too fast to digest. So there's all this really is well documented, this line of exposition in the textbooks and papers and in the literature. So you can go back and maybe get some more of the details. So the bottom line is, if you somehow have a unitary, the ability to implement a unitary, yes?
I didn't follow, but what's the method? What makes it fast?
The factoring algorithm?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll get, that's perfect. I'm going to wrap up with that. So, well, for generic eigenvalue estimation or for factoring? Okay, so I'll answer that. If I don't answer that, then ask me again. Very good question. So if I somehow have the ability to implement a unitary U, say an n qubit unitary, in time, hopefully polynomial in n, and this unitary has a spectrum, has some eigenvectors with some eigenvalues, for a particular psi k, we'll get in the first register an approximation of its eigenvalue. And so if we have a superposition of eigenvectors or a mixture, doesn't matter, just by linearity, we're going to get, if we throw away the second register, say, we're going to get an estimate of a random eigenvalue. Okay. So that's the basic tool. Okay, and this can be good for, you know, you can plug this into other algorithms. For example, if you want to find the ground state, right, and you have a reasonably good guess at preparing the ground state initially, then you could drive it into the ground state using some of the other techniques I'm gonna highlight. So as an example, suppose you have a group G, and you want to find the order of A in that group. Okay. Now, if we know how to efficiently do arithmetic in that group, then we can actually implement a unitary operator that maps strings representing X to strings representing A times X in that group. Because A is invertible, so you can go backwards. I guess we're seriously glossing over all this theory of reversible computation, which was another main ingredient that built up to quantum computation. So I'm unfortunately don't have time to really teach you about reversible computing, but it's documented in those textbooks very clearly. So if we know, this is non-trivial, okay? It's well known and obvious now, but in the 60s and 70s, people really stressed about this. You can map strings representing X to strings representing AX, and with no junk, just unitarily, reversibly do that. And the complexity isn't really much more than how hard it was for you to compute A times X on a piece of paper, right? Or your favorite algorithm. So give me your favorite algorithm for multiplying in that group. With roughly the same complexity, I can reversibly, quantumly map strings representing X to strings representing A times X. Pick your favorite representation of the group elements. So as long as you can map a representative of the group element X to a representative of the group element AX, I don't care. As long as it's a unique representative, then yeah, we don't care. So how does that help us? Well, what this unitary now, which implements multiplication by A, if you raise it to the power of R, that's equal to multiplying by A to the R. What's A to the R? A to the R, R is the order of A, so A to the R is 1 in that group. So multiplying by 1 is the identity map. So UA, this circuit you came up with to multiply by A, is an Rth root of the identity operation. And we really want R, right? That's the million-dollar, billion-dollar problem. So if you're an rth root of the identity operation, then your eigenvalues, your spectrum has to be rth roots of unity. Okay. So now this is where, well, hey, wait a minute, I know how to approximate eigenvalues. Right? And the rest is, if we can approximate these eigenvalues, the rest is just classical post-processing. I use continued fractions to find k over r, and with some luck, I can use that to find r, and then I can use that to factor. But that's just classical post-processing. So let's start off with a classical problem, finding the order of an element in some group. I know how to compute in the group. I can actually physically build an operator, realize an operator that multiplies by a, and that will be an rth root of the identity, so its eigenvalues are rth roots of unity. And then I can plug that into eigenvalue estimation to find r. Now, this relates to the question that one student asked. You know, if I want to, I need an estimate, I need my error to be at most 1 over 2 r squared. So I need to compute u to the x, so ua to the x, for x going from 0, 1, up to 2 r squared, right, to get that that precision. So this doesn't look like an efficient algorithm, right? Because r is going to be on the order of, within a polynomial factor of n, the number you're if you're trying to factor, right, for the purposes to factor the number n, r is going to be within some polynomial factor of n. So if I have to do this multiplication up to poly n times, it's not going to be an efficient algorithm. Okay. But that's what we need for this algorithm to work. Okay. So what's the catch here? Well, so how do you, because we need to do u to the x, right? We want these high powers of the eigenvalues so we can get to the low order bits of the eigenvalues. So the obvious way to exponentiate is just to multiply, right, 2 to the y times. If you want, you know, your controlled u to 2 to the y, one way to implement it is just to repeat that multiplication by a 2 to the y times. But I kind of already gave you, and that'll give you the high power of that eigenvalue parameter. But the point is, you want to do what's been done in classical computing for centuries. For these particular types of unitaries, don't do it this naive way. Multiplying by a 2 to the y times is equivalent to multiplying by a to the 2 to the y. Right? So, and you know, before you implement the quantum circuit, compute what a to 2 to the y is. Right? So you compute, take a, you square it, you get a squared. Then square that, and you get a to the fourth. And square that y times, and you get a to 2 to the y. Right? You do your modular reduction, or whatever your group is. You do your group arithmetic. It's a finite group. So this normally would take poly y steps to compute your a to the 2 to the y. Because you take, it takes y squarings. So it's y times some polynomial. It's y group operations, basically, to classically pre-compute a to the 2 to the y. Then you go to your friend who does the reversible circuits, and they'll implement this circuit for you. All at a cost of about y classical multiplications. So you get this is where you get this exponential boost. Over just doing it naively. Now, in general, you can't fast-forward time. Right? If I give you an arbitrary unitary as a black box and you know nothing about it, no magic hocus-pocus will allow you to do it faster, to run it for time t in less than time t. You can prove, just counting arguments, it's not possible to fast-forward time in general. If you could, you could solve NP complete problems real quickly because you do exhaustive search, you know, really, really fast. So you can't fast-forward general operators, but these operators have some structure, and there's a way to fast-forward them quickly. So with that exponential speed up. Now we can do a comparison again. If you want a rigorous classical algorithm, it takes exponential in square root of log n, log n operations. Most people will quote the best heuristic algorithms, which has log n to the 1/3, log n to the 2/3 for factoring n. This quantum algorithm is polynomial in log n. So you want to do the comparison, it's exponential in log n. It takes linear number of group operations. So it's a huge, huge speed up. I mean, going from square root to 1/3 was a big breakthrough in factoring algorithms. In fact, shaving off constant factors. Here I just put big O, but usually it's some actual constant plus some little o of blah, blah, blah. And then just shaving off the tiniest little thing there is really hard and really important. Okay. Now so I've sort of sketched how this eigenvalue estimation approach to factoring works. Let me go back to how Shor did it originally. He did it first. He computed x times, you know, superposition over inputs, and he just computed the function, a to the x. Then he analyzed it. He just saw, oh, look, there's periodicities. And if I QFT these periodic states, I'm going to get another periodic state where the period is the inverse of the period, where transforms normally do. Now, he traced out the second register, but you don't have to. Right. And then he measured these guys. He got some random number, x over 2 to the n, did some continued fractions to get some k over r for a random k. And if you do the circuit for what I just told you, you start off with a register of zeros. You QFT it to get a superposition over all the inputs x. You do your controlled exponentiation to compute a to the x, and then you Fourier transform the first register and measure and post-process. And the eigenvalue estimation approach, in contrast, you know, what you do is, so now I'm finally going to actually complete the algorithm. Where do you get your eigenvectors from? Well, just put anything here, almost anything. You can put a mixed state if you like, but just put the number 1 down, your group element, the identity of your group represented. Just, and you mathematically write it in terms of eigenvectors of multiplication by A, and you'll get a superposition over eigenvectors that cover the full spectrum. Each eigenvalue is covered exactly once. So you haven't, you QFT the first register, but you do nothing to the second register. The second register you just rewrite in the eigenbasis. Right, and now you do your controlled multiplication by A to the X. Right, so if you have x, you get e to the 2 pi I x times the eigenvalue, which is k over r if you have psi k here. This little thing in the middle, if you QFT it, you'll get something which is peaked at k over r. So this is what eigenvalue estimation does for you. You get a superposition of estimates of k over r tensor psi k eigenvector. You throw away psi k and you measure the first register, you get a good estimate of a random k over r. And the circuit looks like this, which should look familiar. It's exactly the circuit I drew for you for Shor's algorithm. So if you implement them in the way I just did, you get exactly the same circuit. Of course, there's ways of implementing them, so the circuits are a little different. But why is that? Well, they're equivalent, obviously. In Shor's picture, you prepared a superposition of all the inputs. Just had one here. In the eigenvalue estimation, we wrote the second register in the eigenvector basis. So the difference is, on the right-hand side, we're going to analyze things, the second register in the eigenvector basis. And on the left-hand side, in Shor's picture, we're going to analyze it in the computational basis. But it's the same state. You multiply by a to the x. Here you see these periodic states, and you get all the different a to the w values. Here, because you wrote it in the eigenbasis, nothing happens to the second register, all the actions on the first register. Apparently. I mean, obviously there's stuff going on globally. And then when you QFT these guys, these periodic states become periodic with period 1 over r, tensor with these computational states, these basis states. Or on this picture on the right-hand side, if you rewrite the second register in the eigenbasis, then you're entangled in the first register, you have these estimates of k over r. But these are equal. You just picked a different basis for the second register, so of course the first register might look different. but they're equivalent, and if you trace out, if you throw away the second register, you'll get the same density matrix. You get the same state. It'll look different. Like, you average over these pure states, and you're going to get the same thing as when you average over these pure states. And they're physically indistinguishable. It's just, you know, I find it easier to analyze this mixture than that mixture, but it's not really that different. So that's all I'm going to say about factoring and Shor's algorithm and eigenvalue estimation. So if you have any questions about that, I could take those now. Otherwise, I'm going to move on to overview some other algorithmic stuff. So that was sort of the first big, after the initial black box work and Feynman's original idea, that was the big breakthrough that got a lot of people interested in quantum algorithms. Like, what else can we do with these guys? Will it break all public key crypto? Can we solve NP-hard problems on a quantum computer? Can we do more? What other problems can these things solve? And the next big breakthrough in quantum algorithms was by Grover, where he came up with an improved, a quadratically better search algorithm. He called it database search. I think that term can mislead people, because if you really want to search a physical database, then you have to be, like I said, you have to be, earlier, you really have to look at your architecture and see whether you really get a speed up. But in terms of searching a function, a solution space to some function, there's no problem. You get a quadratic speed up in terms of the number of function evaluations. Right? So, particular, there's some function f. It maps n-bit strings to, well, let's just say 0, 1. And we want an x such that f at x is 1. This is a very, very generic problem, right? If you could solve this problem in general, you can solve NP, all of NP. And John Watrous will define NP and explain these things in more detail, but that'd be a big deal. Any problem where you can recognize a solution, so F is like a function or black box that recognizes solutions, right? You really want an F at X is 1. You know how to test a given X, but now you have to find an X such that F at X is 1. That's really hard in general. If you guess, for simplicity, assume, okay, for now, like, this is not a serious assumption, that there exists, you know, a unique solution. Okay, we can guess a solution with probability 1 over 2 to the n. Just randomly guess. But we can actually guess it. What that means is we're guessing it with probability amplitude 1 over root 2 to the n. So the really high-level hand-wavy idea is there some magical quantum way to get the amplitudes to add up? What you want is a way of guessing, and you succeed with probability amplitude 1 over root 2 to the n, and then try again. So you want something approximating this. Something like this. So that after root 2 to the n evaluations, you know, guesses, this is close to 1. That's the idea. Now try to make it work with legal quantum operations. It's not easy at all. But Lov-Grover found a way. It was further analyzed and generalized by Boyer, Brassard, Hoyer, and Tapp, and they called it amplitude amplification. And it subsequently has had many applications. Okay, so in general, you give me any heuristic, any algorithm that succeeds with probability P. So if A guesses A, so it doesn't have to be uniform guesses, solution classically, you'd have to repeat, you know, you'd have to guess 1 over p times. If you had something which succeeded with probability p at finding a solution, you repeat it roughly 1 over p times, you expect, you know, that's roughly how many times you have to repeat it before you find the solution. But with this quantum searching, you only have to repeat, with amplitude amplification, the square root of that. So that's, in practice, that's a huge, that's an important speed up. Again, you have to actually look at the architecture and the actual implementation. But in terms of the number of times you have to query f, you get a quadratic speed up. And it's a very broadly, so we don't get the super polynomial advantage, but it's a very, very widely applicable algorithm. So that was the state of the art in 96, basically. And there's a misconception. So a lot of people stopped following the field in 96, and they think nothing's happened since then on the implementation side or the algorithmic side or the error correction side. They think we're still in 1996. So 1996 was also the year, more or less, that quantum people figured out how to harness, how to control quantum errors, at least started laying the initial, the groundwork. Right? Because in 95 or 94, people thought, oh, we can't do error correction because we can't look at, you know, all the reasons why the obvious approaches to error correction won't work, and maybe there's a fundamental reason we can't build quantum computers. But by 96, we realized there's no real fundamental issue. You just don't look at the state, just look at the error syndrome. Right? And if you only measure what error occurred, then you don't destroy your quantum coherence and everything's fine. And, oh, look, you can do it fault-tolerantly. There's a threshold. A lot of work still needed to be done, but the basic principles were laid out. And a lot has happened in the last 10 years on making it practical and you know, a much broader range of tools. The threshold's been improved tremendously, better ways for analyzing fault tolerance and so on. But we have three speakers talking about error correction and fault tolerance, so I think they'll be able to convince you of that much better than I can. But a lot has happened on error correction since 96, and a lot has happened on implementations. Both theory and practice of implementations. Right? The stuff they're doing in the lab today is unbelievable compared to what we thought it could do in 96. And the theory of building stuff, the architectures that could work, that has expanded tremendously since then. In 96, there was a handful of experiments, and we more or less knew what they were. Now it's impossible to keep track. And in algorithms, the first few years after 96 were quite frustrating because we wanted a really new algorithm. And that was hard. I mean, initially we were improving and generalizing and better understanding the existing algorithms, but a lot of really new stuff has happened as well. So let me go over some of the main areas where things have happened. So simulations have really been developed in much more detail, and there's still much more to do. But the generic simulations have been studied much more carefully, better improvement of the polynomial factors, different frameworks for studying different kinds of simulation questions, and also applications to specific problems. So a lot has happened there. I think there's no real good survey for all of this stuff. There's a ton of material. That's one of the problems. But, I gave a very, very superficial survey of this area in the one survey paper I did. But so I'm not going to say much more about this, but a lot has happened. One of the papers I mentioned earlier is looking at the time-dependent, because we usually say, you know, a time-dependent Hamiltonian can be thought of as a bunch of time-independent ones that, you know, that you change very often, right? So you can throw up the polynomial factors, maybe it's no big deal, but they're optimizing it for time-varying Hamiltonians. So there's a lot of interesting stuff to be done on the basic tools and also on the applications. That has been done and there's still to be done. So one of the first lines of research that was started and is still continuing is generalizing Simon's problem and order finding and the discrete logarithm problem into what is known as a hidden subgroup problem. So one way to unify a lot of the algorithms, most of the algorithms known in 96, 6, apart from searching, was you have a function that maps a group G, let's say a finite group or a finitely generated group, to some finite set X. And f at X equals f at Y if and only if X and Y are in the same coset of some subgroup of G. Right? So the coset of X equals the coset of Y for some hidden subgroup S of G. So there exists a subgroup, and it's implicitly defined by this function. So information theoretically, once you have the function, you have S. But algorithmically, you might have a nightmare of a time finding S. So factoring can be rephrased this way, right? Where G is just the integers, and F maps the integer X to A to the X mod N. So N is the integers mod, X is the integers modulo N. Notice F at X equals F at Y if X and Y differ by a multiple of R. So the subgroup S is just R times the integers, is the additive group, R times the integers. So you can put order finding in this framework. Simon's algorithm is straightforwardly in this framework. Discrete logs can be massaged to look like this. And more or less the same algorithm works. So if G is abelian and finitely generated and represented in some reasonable way. Right, so one of the students asked about how things are represented. That is important. But as long as you have unique representatives, now normally we just for simplicity say unique classical representative. But some cool ideas of some cool work has been done by John Watrous and others, having actually a quantum state represent your group elements, and that helped us overcome some technical hurdles. But you need a unique physical representative, so you get quantum interference, and efficiently compute the operations. Then we can efficiently find S with those caveats, but they're usually satisfied in most cases. We can find S. But so then we said, well, what about non-abelian groups? So graph automorphism is a special case of a non-abelian hidden subgroup problem. It's a really nice one. So G is a graph. I should use a different font, but so G is a graph on N vertices. Pi is a permutation of the numbers 1 to n, and we can let f map pi to, I'm just going to call it, so pi acting on the graph, and all it does is it takes the graph and it permutes the nodes according to the permutation. Okay. And graph automorphism is asking, is there a pi that maps G to itself, other than the identity? Right? If there is, then you have a non-trivial automorphism group. So such a pi is called an automorphism. They form a closed subgroup. Right? The big question is the subgroup trivial or not? And this pi, this automorphism group of G, is a subgroup of Sn. And it's a hidden subgroup. It's hidden by this really easy to implement function. It takes permutations, maps them to the graph permuted by that permutation. Easy to implement function. It hides the automorphism group. If you could solve the hidden subgroup problem, even the decision version of the hidden subgroup problem, is the hidden subgroup non-trivial, you would solve a really important problem. If you could do it in poly time. There's sub-exponential algorithms for it classically. Now, I don't have time to get into the nuances between black box algorithms and non-black box algorithms. But often what we try to do is, if our approach is to solve the problem by implementing F like a black box, where we don't look at the guts of F, we just say, okay, I'm going to apply this function F so many times, do all this other weird stuff and solve the problem, that's effectively a black box algorithm. And so what we try to do is say, well, how many black box queries do we need? Because if we seem to need exponentially many queries, well, then we're done. We're toast anyway. We won't have an efficient algorithm. So we try to come up with efficient black box algorithms. And once we have an efficient black box algorithm, then we say, oh, well, can we get all the other operations, the non-black box operations, to also be efficient? And sometimes we can, and sometimes we don't know. So what Ettinger, Hoyer, and Knill showed was that the number of queries, the number of black box, the number of times you have to apply F is polynomial. Polynomial in the log of the, you know, the size of the group. Well, not the graph, but the group, which is actually poly related to the size of the graph. So the query complexity is kind of trivial. So then the hard part is, well, can you do all the non-query stuff in poly time? They showed this for all of hidden subgroup problems, not just graph isomorphism or automorphism. That's still an open problem, a very much open problem. But we've learned a lot. We'd like to be able to do more, but we have learned a lot. So the first thing people tried is Fourier transforms, because you can define a Fourier transform in terms of representation theory on any group. So you can define it on these non-abelian groups, and in some cases you can implement the Fourier transform. So mimic Shor's algorithm. You just start with superposition of X, compute F at X, do the Fourier transform, why not, and then see if that works. Some success, but it's limited, right? It works in some cases. For example, if the hidden subgroup's normal and you can actually implement the Fourier transform, things work out okay. More recently, people phrased, you know how you can think of the factoring as a phase estimation? Well, you can think of it more generally. These more general things can be reduced to some sort of state estimation or state distinguishability problems. And then we can go to the physics literature because they've studied state estimation and distinguishability. But think of it as a distinguishability problem and apply some tools there, optimal measurement theory, or you don't need the optimal measurement necessarily. It's often a pretty good measurement, so this was actually an existing term in the literature, is enough. So information theoretically, we know the optimal measurement will solve the problem. How hard is it to actually implement the optimal measurement? We don't know, but a pretty good measurement's good enough. Is that easier? Sometimes a pretty good measurement is the optimal measurement, but it's usually enough. And sometimes we know how to implement these relaxations of the optimal measurements. So, for example, for the Heisenberg group and other groups too. So this is one line of research that many people have been working on. Another technique called sieving, which I won't explain here, but it has a pretty different flavor from the other stuff. Okay. Introduced by Cooperberg and Regev. And then there's other approaches which don't resemble either of these two. So for example, they do some really non-trivial group theory to reduce your non-abelian hidden subgroup to several instances of the abelian hidden subgroup in some weird abelian group. This non-trivial classical work to reduce it to this problem we already know how to solve. So, example, these nilpotent groups, certain types of nilpotent groups, and so on. So, a lot of non-trivial mathematics and algorithmic work to solve a few extra cases of the non-abelian hidden subgroup. We'd all love to solve graph isomorphism, graph automorphism, but we're not even close. We're just taking groups which are barely non-abelian and seeing what we can do with those. Another way to generalize the hidden subgroup paradigm is to think of it, you can think of hidden subgroups, you know, finitely generated groups can be thought of as sublattices, they're equivalent to the lattice, Z tensors, This shouldn't be tensor product, but it should just be Cartesian product. Sorry about that. This is Cartesian product. You can think of hidden subgroups as hidden sublattices, and it's essentially the same thing, you just call them something else. But then you might say, well, but what if instead of Z, I work with the reals? All right, of course, you have a proxy, it starts to get messy, but you can make it work. And if you do this, you can solve, there's sort of an analogous algorithm, but it's non-trivial to make it work. But then you can start solving some non-trivial number theory problems, for example, such as solving Pell's equations, principal ideal problem, unit group of a number field, which are very nice number theoretic problems. And there are also, some of these have been used as these alternative crypto systems I was telling you about. one of the first ones, you know, so RSA is gone, elliptic curve crypto and discrete log is gone. But there's this other stuff based on, you know, the class group and so on of number fields, which seems to be robust against Shor's algorithm because the group structure is kind of not quite a group structure. But Sean Holgren figured out how to do that, and other people too have worked in this area as well. So we solved some really cool number theory problems, computational number theory problems, and the cryptographers are following this very closely because a lot of the ideas for public key crypto come from computational number theory. And then people said, well, what about instead of hiding subgroups, can we hide other structures, right, such as a hidden circle or certain hidden shifts and hidden polynomials? And there's been a few nice papers on solving these problems. You have to come up with new tools. It's not just, you know, I have the solution already and I'm inventing new problems for it. These are require new tools, hidden shifts and hidden translations. And again, some of them also have cryptographic applications. Most of these are sort of black box problems. And it's sometimes you can naturally come up with a real-world problem that has that black box structure, like factoring. Order finding, you can think you just invent a group and ask what's the order of this element, and you can treat that as a black box, but it's a real problem. And another real problem was approximating these Gauss sums. There's no black boxes here. I actually give you the prime, and then you give me all the you describe the character function, and I forget what this E is right now. But this is the function of actual parameters. The problem is to compute this gamma parameter. So you give me the field and then a couple other inputs, get finitely described inputs. The norm of the answer is fixed, but the phase parameter is not fixed, and you want to approximate gamma. And we can do that super polynomially better than is known. Right, this is as hard as discrete logs in the finite field, which we believe is hard classically, but we can do that efficiently on a quantum computer. In the late 90s, we were, you know, so many of us were looking at this hidden subgroup paradigm and trying to milk it for all it was worth, and with limited success, but there has been some success and very hard-fought success over the past 10 years. Other people were like, well, let's try something really new. Let's look for a fundamentally new algorithmic paradigm. And they started looking at quantum walks, because classical random walks are a very successful algorithmic tool classically. So they're like, what would the quantum version look like? And in the late 90s, they were looking at very primitive tools and analyzing them. And over the last 10 years, they've been applied to solve some interesting problems. So if you're looking at so-called mixing time of a classical random walk, you can get up to a quadratic speedup. But if you're looking for a hitting time, the time it takes to find something in a certain structure, then you can get up to an exponential speedup. We don't have many examples, but we have some examples. So what do I mean by? So, for example, if you're trying to solve this problem, you're trying to find an x such that f at x is 1. Well, what you can do is you pick a random x. You pick x at random from the string, you know, and then you look at it. If it's a solution, great. If it isn't, you somehow have a rule for going from x, you flip a few bits of x and go to some other x. And then you try that. And if that doesn't work, you might flip a couple more bits and try that. Right? And that implicitly defines a walk. You can define, you know, here's x1. These are strings, right? x2. You know, so you guess a string, and then if that one doesn't work, then you walk to another string. And it's a deterministic rule. Well, the rule is you randomly pick some neighbor of this guy, and so on. So implicitly, there's a graph with certain transition probabilities. This is the probability of going from x1 to x2, and so on. But you can analyze it as walking a drunk guy walking on a graph, right? Where he's at some node, flips some coins, and walks to another node, and you're just walking around this graph. So, but algorithmically, the nodes are usually something, some structure that you have represented, and you walk, you just, you look, if it's good, if you've hit it, if you've found what you're looking for, you've hit it, you're happy and you're done. Otherwise, you just keep walking. So we can get some exponential speed up for hitting times. There's two types of quantum walks people developed. Initially, the computer scientists were coming up with discrete time versions where they would quantize a coin. They would treat the coins you use to decide where to go. They treated that as part of the system and quantized them and so on just to see how it worked. But the physicists, they said, well, why don't you just take this, treat it as, take the adjacency matrix of the graph, treat it as a Hamiltonian of your system, and see what that buys you. In recent years, some search algorithms, so essentially solving variants of this problem, the best known algorithms are quantum walk algorithms. So you can use the walk paradigm to come up with the state-of-the-art search algorithms. So initially, people were just saying, oh, let's walk on a line. And you're like, well, what algorithmic problem are you going to solve that you can't just do by, you know, exhaustive search? And we didn't really have many answers back then, but they were just trying to develop the paradigm. But in recent years, and even as early as 2003 or so, people started actually solving problems, interesting problems in this paradigm. So element distinctness, you get a much lower query complexity. So, you know, the question is, here's a function f, are there two inputs with the same output? So it doesn't go to 0, 1, it goes to some other domain or range. Are there two inputs with the same output? Okay, we can beat the classical algorithms in terms of the number of times you evaluate f, and so on, and finding other, solving other graph theoretic problems. So there's the discrete and the continuous. The continuous time walk, you kind of mathematically define it. You talk about evolving the Hamiltonian, but then you're like, well, but how do I actually implement the algorithm? Like, what's the point of having a polytime algorithm if there's no actual computer that implements it? So there's the obvious answer is, well, we're going to apply those Hamiltonian simulation algorithms to efficiently simulate those evolutions, and we're done. But recently people realized you can do something even more clever and efficient, which is take the continuous algorithm and simulate it with a discrete time walk, which has the same spectral properties and therefore the same running times and so on. So the exponential speed up for a quantum walk, the first one was this glued trees problem, where, you know, again, these nodes are labeled with strings, and you have some string, you know, and you know how to walk from a node to its three neighbors. And you're given the label of the entrance node, and then you can query for all the neighbors of any node you like. So you're at this node, it's labeled with the word entrance, and then you're given the label of these two guys. You can go to one or the other or both in superposition, it's up to you, and then you can go to their neighbors. And you can very quickly find this part here, and you're kind of oriented. But then these guys and these guys over here are connected by a random cycle. So once you step from here to here, okay, you're going to get three neighbors. One of them is where you just were, so you know which one that is. But then you can't tell then you get one guy which is moving you towards the exit and the other guy moving you back towards the entrance. And you have no way of knowing which way is forward and which way is backwards. Okay. So if you try to classically solve this problem by just an oracle that tells you all the neighbors, you can prove it takes exponential time to find the exit. Quantumly, you can plow through to that exit in almost linear time. Okay. So polynomial time, find that exit. And the proof technique is kind of cool. They look at symmetric space, they look at the symmetries, and they reduce it to walking on a line. So remember those walking on a line algorithms, which I said it wasn't clear what they're good for? Well, it turns out they're a good way to analyze something like this. Right, you get this exponential speed up. What is this good for in terms of solving a problem I actually care about? We don't know yet. But it's nice to have this primitive. The history of quantum algorithms is, you know, you come up with some idea, and then you come up with a primitive, and then eventually we hopefully apply them to something more interesting. This quantum walk, the continuous time quantum walk paradigm was also used to solve this NAND tree problem. So NAND is the not of the AND. So you compute the AND, like the AND is 1 if and only if both inputs are 1, and the not is you flip that answer. So you have a binary tree, and you know, the NAND of 0 and 1 is, well, the AND is 0, so the NAND is 1, and so on, and you just recursively compute, and you finally get the answer. So the input is all the bit values at the leaves of the tree, and the output is the value at the root. And the, for many years, the best-known quantum algorithm was just to run the classical algorithm. Quantum searching didn't help, and we tried hard, and we couldn't do it. And then the physicists said, well, let's treat this as the adjacency matrix of a graph. Let's look at the adjacency matrix of this and treat it as a Hamiltonian of a system. And they glued it onto a long line or a big ring, and they just studied the properties of this thing, and they were able to come up with a square root n algorithm, which, you know, was what we had lower bounds, but we had nothing close in terms of algorithms. And then if this is a continuous algorithm, but then you can make it discrete and so on. So lots of cool stuff's been done with quantum walk. These are just two recent examples. And you know, useful stuff too, like these quantum search algorithms. And there's been other, in the last few years, non-trivial applications of amplitude amplification. There's a lot of trivial ones. They're easy. But then people have really gone into the guts of sophisticated algorithms and showed how we could use this quantum searching as a really useful primitive. Another really clever idea by the physicists was to use the adiabatic theorem to our advantage and come up with what they called adiabatic algorithms. I won't have much time to explain how they work, but the idea is really cool. So what physicists have known for almost a century is if you start in a system which is in the ground state of some Hamiltonian, H1, H0, and you slowly change the Hamiltonian. You slowly change, you know, the energy function of the system to some other Hamiltonian. With high probability, you'll still be in the ground state of this guy if you go slowly enough. And if some other assumptions are promised, you'll stay in the ground state. If you go slowly enough, and there's other assumptions I haven't told you. So the idea is, pick a Hamiltonian where it's easy to find the ground state, and then slowly change the Hamiltonian by linearly interpolating, for example. So over time t, I mean, there's other ways to interpolate, but slowly change over to this Hamiltonian, slowly enough. You'll end up in the ground state of this guy. Now, it's easy to come up with Hamiltonians where finding the ground state is really hard, is NP hard, for example, or harder. So that's the algorithm. Your problem is some Hamiltonian with a really hard ground state, and the way I'm going to find that ground state is I'm going to start in some Hamiltonian with an easy ground state and change it slowly enough so it stays in the ground state. The hard part is how slow is slow, and proving that it works and so on. You can prove you get a quadratic speed up for searching in this paradigm. And we tried hard to prove it was no better than that, but that kind of failed. We just never succeeded. So there was no real home runs in this paradigm, but it's interesting. And people showed a slight generalization of this framework gives you universal quantum computing. So that's when I gave up trying to prove no-go theorems, because it does a slight generalization of this is universal. So which means it's a useful paradigm to think of algorithms in, if you can, if you'd like to. Another completely different looking paradigm, again in the late 90s, the idea, you know, Friedman thought, what if we build a topological type quantum computer? It might be able to solve some hard topological problems really easily, such as computing the Jones certain topological invariants like the Jones polynomial. Right? Exact solution of this is number p hard, which is harder than np hard. So np hard is asking, is there a solution? Is there an x such that f at x is 1? where x is some polytime computable function. Number p hard is solves problems of the form how many x's satisfy f at x is 1. So it's even harder. But it, you know, if you looked at it in detail, it did the precision kind of killed you. It didn't work, but it was a really nice idea. And then furthermore, it was shown that this computing paradigm is polytime equivalent to standard quantum computing. So it's useful as a paradigm, because if you can think of algorithms for topological problems in this computing model, great. But it's equivalent, ultimately, to the circuit model. So we can implement it with a standard quantum computer. And this paradigm has been generalized further into what people call the tensor network algorithms. And this is surveyed in the paper with Jamie. Anyway, so I'll move on. So these are a whole host of different developments. They all look pretty different to me. Very different from the original algorithms back in 96. And I haven't even, these are mostly, for the most part, I'm talking about algorithms with the classical input and classical output. But we'll also need quantum algorithms for purely quantum tasks, or partially quantum tasks. You know, quantum input, classical output, or quantum, or classical quantum, or quantum quantum. Like sometimes we'll need a certain quantum state. How do we generate it? Or quantum error correction is sort of a quantum algorithm. We have a quantum output, a quantum input, and a quantum output. The quantum input is a state with some noise that has just been applied to it, and then you want to do stuff to it to get a noise-free version of it. Quantum signatures, quantum data compression, entanglement concentration, or some more mathematical problems, but they're still quantum in nature. So this is still new territory. But I think we're going to see more and more algorithms for purely quantum tasks over time, too. So speculating into the future, I hope we eventually resolve this non-abelian hidden subgroup problem. Some deep understanding as to why they're hard, or maybe find them easy. We don't, I think most of us are, well, if we had to bet, we'd probably bet that the hardest cases are indeed hard, but we don't know for sure. But if once we develop some confidence that they're hard, we can maybe use them in some other public key crypto. There's probably lots of mileage still to be gained by looking at where you can apply amplitude amplification or quantum walk-based search. Or just more applications of quantum walks. Because stuff like these glue trees, we get this exponential speed up, but can we use those ideas and solve some interesting problems with an exponential speed up? Some people might think we've resolved this, and maybe they're right. I guess I don't understand a unified theory of quantum walks yet. But there's a lot has been developed recently. Because in the beginning, we had, you know, we're trying stuff. So there was coined walks, no coined walks, and Segedi and Ambinus and went a long way, and others. And there's continuous versus discrete. And the relationship is much better understood now. But there's probably still room for clarification. It would be nice if we could find an adiabatic algorithm with more than a quadratic speed-up with a rigorous proof that it works. That would be cool. And just if we could build a quantum computer, we could just test these algorithms. Because the main problem is we can't prove that they work. Sometimes we prove they don't work, but then they just you can change the algorithm a bit, and then we can't prove anything anymore. So that's something I'd like to see eventually resolved. And this tensor network stuff is still kind of new. There's a few examples. I'd like to see where that goes. And I'm still extremely interested in algorithms for more physics problems. Right? And so Matt Hastings is going to talk about this. Guifre Vidal is going to talk about related work as well. Guifre is mostly interested in classical algorithms for these simulations. What I'm interested in is, well, what can you not do, Guifre, with the classical computer? And what guys like John Watrous and the complexity theorists haven't proved is NP-hard or QMA-hard, and then maybe there's a quantum algorithm for these problems. So really, it's a hard area of research. I worked with Suche Wei for, I don't know, quite a long time trying to just make a small dent into this sort of stuff. But it's a really nice area to work in. So I'll stop there. I'm happy to take questions or talk with anybody throughout the day. Thanks a lot for your attention. So if there's no more questions, I guess we can break for lunch.